Welcome back, everyone, to another day here at The Damage Report. I'm John Adirola, very lucky to be joined on the program once again by comedian, actor, writer, host, probably other things besides River Butcher. Welcome back to the show.
What's up, John? Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm also a utility infielder for my baseball team, if you want to add that on the intro.
The athletic aspect.
Bench coach and utility infielder. What's up, John? How are you? Great to be back.
I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah.
A little bit of behind the scenes info for everyone, because we believe in maximum transparency. I am doing something that I do probably 3 times a year, which is make a Hail Mary attempt to reset my totally unhealthy, insane caffeine consumption.
Mm.
And so I'm doing that right now and I'm feeling it.
How's that going?
So that's going to be working in the background of the commentary. If I get very angry at the drop of a hat, that's probably why. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I am not resetting my caffeine consumption. I'm all in. I've already had my 2 coffees for today. And maybe I'll have a third just for you, John. I'll pour one out for you.
Thank you. Well, I want to be clear. When I say reset, I don't mean to zero. I mean to like less than 2. I've already had coffee today.
It's wow.
I'm used to a lot. We run hot here at TDR. But anyway, we've got a lot of news for River and I to jump into in just a little bit. It turns out there have been some text messages that we need to talk about. Also, Elon Musk, pretty much the worst. More and more people agreeing with that concept every day. That'll be fun. And then a whole lot more news. Good people, bad people, interesting scientific developments, although I may not have the view of it that you might expect based on past commentary on technology on the channel. So anyway, there's lots to look forward to, both on the first hour as well as the aftermath. So everyone buckle up for that. Please hit the like button if you haven't already, so people know we're live. And if you want to send us any comments, tweets, or super chats, River and I will respond as we go. But with all that said, River, are you ready to start the show?
I'm ready, John.
Okay. Let's do this thing. We're gonna start with one of the big ones. Surprise, surprise. The former chief of staff of Donald Trump, Mark Meadows, was involved in literally hundreds of text messages in the weeks leading up to and following the insurrection of January 6th, with literally dozens of members of Congress on the Republican side. And while a lot was communicated in these text messages, many crazy accusations and conspiracy theories and legal ideas and philosophical concepts, the through line is fairly clear. Joe Biden cannot be allowed to become president no matter what it takes, no matter what it takes in DC, no matter what it takes in states throughout the country. Something has got to be done. And some of these text messages are absolutely damning. So we're gonna jump into all of it. So first of all, credit to Talking Points Memo for getting access to these text messages. We've got 34 members of Congress talking with Mark Meadows. These are initially a part of the trove of text messages that were given to the January 6th committee investigating that attack. By the way, months ago, there was someone who had been sort of like cast out of the committee. And committee members were talking a little bit of smack about this individual. We talked about it at the time. But that person said in their book that they released that Mark Meadows, his texts are like the real deal, and that's what we need to see. Turns out that person was onto something. But anyway, Meadows received at least 364 messages from members of Congress, which I think we can all agree is way too many text messages. Don't be blowing up my phone. He sent at least 95 messages of his own. And I'm not gonna make you wait for maybe the single most damning message. This came on January 17th, which is an important fact. We're gonna return to that, but it comes from Ralph Norman, GOP representative. And he messaged then chief of staff to the president of the United States, Mark, in seeing what's happening so quickly and reading about the Dominion lawsuits attempting to stop any meaningful investigation, we're at a point of no return in saving our republic. Exclamation point, exclamation point. Our last hope is invoking martial with an SH law. Please urge to president to do so. I don't know if he's supposed to go to a marshals. I don't know. It's martial as in having to do with martial prowess and martial force. I think you should know what the word is if you're gonna use it to invoke the end of constitutional democracy. And you shouldn't then immediately transition to please urge to president to do so. You're calling for the end of our way of government. can you have a little bit of gravitas to it? But no, for Ralph Norman, this was an emergency. They needed to stop Biden from becoming president. And I want to return to the fact I pointed out earlier. It would be treasonous enough were this text to have been sent January 4th. This was not sent on January 4th. This was sent on January 17th. This is what this GOP representative was saying and calling for a week after the insurrection. We'd already had that. People were dead at this point. Over 100 cops were recovering in the hospital. And after all of that and a national conversation about the need to potentially impeach Donald Trump over this, Ralph Norman thought, you know what? No, we need to double down. We need to end this thing 3 days before the inauguration. This is our last Hail Mary attempt to stop this thing. River, what do you think?
I mean, I think he got I just think it's the Marshall's thing is so funny to me. Just like he's spending his Kohl's cash trying to sway the election. I mean, it's just it's very clear to me that none of this is a surprise. I'm also shocked that none of them use like encryption, but at the same time, not so shocked. Because wasn't it Gates was like leaving little emojis on his transactions with his friendly sex workers and all those things. I mean, these people are so bold, emboldened these days that they just leave trails and evidence everywhere because they're so convinced that they're gonna get away with all of it. And so far, so good, honestly. And so it's like not a big shock to me. I'm also curious, where is Norman a rep from? What state?
I did not actually get it down. I'm gonna find out for you right now.
I'm on a very tiny computer, so I didn't look it up.
Okay, we're in South Carolina.
South Carolina, yeah.
Yes.
It's not surprising to me that you'd be very convinced this would work.
Exactly. Yeah. Look, they're not sending their best. People might be surprised to find out. What's that?
It's on purpose.
Yeah.
Not having the best, like you were saying, you know, like needing to know the procedure, needing to know like spelling the words. Now, I don't want to be classist. I'm not like a classist about spelling, misspell all the things. But it's purposeful in the GOP to have people that they can control and maneuver and manipulate into believing whatever they want in these stations of government. It's fully purposeful.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's classist to expect that those who are going to institute an authoritarian government, like at least nail the punctuation. But anyway, TPM reached out to Ralph Norman. He said he wanted a chance to review his messages before commenting, saying, it's been 2 years. Send that text to me and I'll take a look at it. So they did. He never responded, which I sort of get. He was, after all, calling for a coup. Again, Donald Trump got in a little bit of trouble like 2 weeks ago, a week ago, when he said that he was in favor of the Constitution being terminated. And that is effectively what this guy wanted, what many of them wanted in one form or another. And again, we're just supposed to move on. We're not supposed to be freaked out about this. We're supposed to somehow be convinced that they're not gonna have another go at this, another round of this at the state level. You got Carrie Lake trying to, you know, contest the results of her election right now. Look, I'm gonna briefly skim through a couple of the other text messages. There's literally hundreds of them that you can find. But we've got this message. Again, I believe this is from Ralph Norman. This is from Jason Miller, apologies, campaign advisor to Donald Trump, describing Representative Mo Brooks as the ringleader on the January 6th deal. So that's an interesting little tidbit for Mo Brooks to deal with as we go forward. You got Representative Brian Babin of Texas sending nearly 24 messages to Mark Meadows and receiving 4 responses. On November 6th, this is what he said. Mark, when we lose Trump, we lose our republic. Fight like hell and find a way. Just find a way anyway. We're with you down here in Texas and refuse to live under a corrupt Marxist dictatorship. Liberty, Babin. He signs his text Babin rather than babbling, which seems more appropriate. He didn't respond to requests for comment either. Maybe he's on the run. After all, he has been living under a Marxist dictatorship for 2 years. And don't you love them saying, we need to do whatever it takes to not live under a dictatorship. Honestly, damn the law, damn the Constitution, Trump for life. I refuse to live under a dictatorship. That is some amazing doublethink from Babin there.
Oh, it's a beautiful hypocrisy. The goalposts are moving so much. It's like you know those little ice hockey games for kids? Uh-huh. It's just like that. But the whole thing is moving. I don't know how they keep it all straight other than they just are like, I'm right all the time. That is how you keep your like political compass straight when you're moving all your goalposts, is remember that you are right all the time. I also think it's funny. Yeah. I've been to Texas. I perform in Texas. I have friends in Texas. They are not living in a Marxist dictatorship in Texas, I'll tell you what. And even the most liberal people that I know in Texas are like, absolutely not.
Yeah, 100%. Okay, couple more points. Representative Mark Green of Tennessee. Tennessee's got some problems here. Sent a message saying Dick Morris is saying state ledge can intervene and declare Trump winner. You could do it in North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, all have GOP ledge. And he sends a link to a Newsmax article. Mark Green, I'm gonna blow your mind. Just because Dick Morris says something doesn't make it true. But look at that. That is not, the text wasn't, we found good reasons to suspiciously question the results in only the number of states we need to get to the electoral count threshold that we want. It's just saying we have control here. Who cares who won? We can just declare him the winner. Again, there are a bunch of dozens of these people still in office. Would love to see some hard questions for them about why they felt so comfortable reaching out to the number one guy for the president with their treasonous and seditious comments. There's a lot of other nonsense too. I'm not gonna get into everything. There's Dominion conspiracy theories and QAnon stuff, and there's, but like, look at how hard these people will fight to save Trump. Have you ever seen them fight like this for access to reasonable rent or the ability to afford health insurance? Have you ever seen them fight for regular, even just conservatives, the way they will fight this desperate life or death fight to save the political fortunes of Donald Trump? Any final thoughts, River?
I mean, to me, this is just a classic hostile takeover. It is a corporate move, you know? Like when they say Republic, they mean their money. They mean all their backdoor deals, you know? And like, I think you make a great point, John. It has been a long time, not in my lifetime perhaps, that any Republican or conservative, or even moderate for that matter, has fought this hard to do anything for the citizens of the, or I shouldn't even say citizens, people of this country, yeah, and specifically the working class people that they use and abuse as their like human shield to win elections. And this is their propagandist way of keeping those people voting for them.
Yeah. I want to, you know, I was going to move on, but I think we need to stop for just a second because this is an important point. With all of these Mark Meadows text messages coming out, we stand at a very important point, I think, for our country. We know that within 2 weeks or so, the January 6th commission, which won't last much longer than that, it's gonna be dissolved by the Republicans in less than a month, is going to make their final report. They say there's going to be some sort of presentation or something. They're gonna be doing it right in the lead up to Christmas. I'm not sure if that's the best idea, but that's what they're doing. And supposedly they're gonna be criminal referrals, although we don't know if that's gonna include Donald Trump. They know, definitely, and I sort of understand why they would wait. They're not going to leak that 2 weeks before doing it, because that gives, you know, the Republicans time to respond and everything. But even then, it's just gonna be a referral. It's not, it's just advice basically to the DOJ to do something about this. And we know that we've got the special, you know, the special investigation going on and all of these others. And my fear is that despite all of what we've seen in these text messages and the million steps of this scandal that have led up to this point, we already knew there were so many different reasons that they might not do anything, despite the clear illegality and the threat posed, constitutional threat being posed by these people. Because just briefly, remember, these text messages are coming from people who were representatives after the 2020 election, immediately after the election, not the sort of crazies that have been elected at the national level and in state legislatures throughout the country after the big lie, when the Republican Party has been going out and looking for people whose only qualification is a belief that elections are whatever you want them to be and Donald Trump is a God king. Those people are gonna be even crazier. They're gonna be in positions of power all throughout the country, when and if this, the second round of this happens. We already know that they're worried about the political implications of charges against Donald Trump. But now I'm sort of wondering, you know, like I've said for the audience, I mean, you know, I've said as dangerous as Donald Trump is, I feel like him as a candidate makes it much less likely that the Republicans win in 2024 and makes it more likely that they put forward, you know, more horrible Senate candidates and all that. What if that's part of the consideration being made by like the Democrats? Like maybe they're already disinclined to put charges up against Trump because they're afraid of their own shadows. What if they think, well, but if we do that, then maybe he won't be the candidate. And then maybe it'll be someone else who has a better chance of winning. And look, I want a bad candidate on the Republican side, but I also believe that the law is the law and there should be consequences for breaking it. I don't know. I've thrown a lot out there, River. What do you think?
I mean, it sounds like a game of 4D chess. And I like what you're saying. You know, I mean, I do think there are like implications on for, there's no sides, but for both sides in the political arena. To making indictments and all these things. I don't think anything happens to Donald Trump because nothing ever happens to Donald Trump. No matter what you do to that guy, no matter what you do to that guy, he gets out of it and he makes it work for him. So I think, you know, in a long term, and 2024 to me is long term, I'm not saying don't put this stuff out there, put the truth out there. I think that's what's the most important, but criminal charges, no criminal charges, like it kind of is irrelevant. But I do think that knowing all these backdoor machinations of the GOP is important for the upcoming elections. And I think that personally, these other elections are more important in regards to this information that like we need more, you know, independent and democratic representation in Congress and Senate and lower than that specifically. But I do agree with you, John. I'm curious to see what happens over Christmas.
I know. Will there be a Christmas miracle? Yeah, and we need people at all these different levels who take this threat seriously. The Democrats had a chance to pass some sort of comprehensive voting rights bill, and they chose not to do that. They've made some small changes, like making it even more clear that the vice president doesn't just get to decide who becomes president, as if that needed to be more clear. But there are still so many ways that people could mess with this system. And there are some of the craziest, most conspiratorial people in the country are now in positions of power to do that in a number of different states. And I feel like there is a lot of Democrats that still are not taking that threat nearly serious enough. Anyway, with that said, we're gonna take our first break. Come back though, lots more news to get to. Okay, well, regardless, the news must go on. So we're gonna jump into it. Thank you, Cliff, for your continued efforts. I do appreciate it. No, it's not your fault. You didn't do anything. Thank you. Okay. Elon Musk is one of the most wealthy people in the world and has tons of acolytes and cultists who endlessly do PR for him on social media. You wouldn't think he would need an assist from one of the biggest media companies in the country, but that's what he's getting. Here's a tweet from the New York Times. News analysis. Elon Musk has tweeted about political topics regularly since taking over Twitter, often belittling some liberal causes. But what he stands for remains largely unclear. The headline, by the way, is critics say Musk has revealed himself as a conservative. It's not so simple. And we're gonna give them a chance to make their case there at the New York Times. But already, this is what they're going to do. Elon Musk has maybe only exceeded by Kanye West this year, revealed who he truly is and what he believes. He has tried to do nothing but that. Make clear who he likes, who he doesn't, who he wants to be in positions of influence and power. But for the New York Times, he is more importantly a billionaire, and their knee-jerk need to run cover for billionaires is very much on display. Here is just a little bit of their argument. You could read the full article if you'd like. Elon Musk, ever a bundle of contradictions and inconsistencies, has long made his politics tricky to pin down. Yet Mr. Musk, who did not respond to a request for comment, continues to defy easy political categorization. His views have been described as libertarian, though these days his politics seem more contrarian than anything else. He is more clear about what he is against than what he is for. I just want to quickly say that I understand that contrarianism is on an uptick on social media. Have you ever noticed that contrarians are never contrarianly progressive? Have you ever noticed that contrarians almost always are people who used to claim to be progressive or liberal or on the left or something like that, and now suddenly agree with the right on literally everything? If you're a contrarian and you just respond to whatever you see by saying the opposite, why is it that that never leads to you being super left? Isn't that weird? I think that's something to consider going forward. Anyway, finally, they say, it's true, Mr. Musk certainly sounds a lot like a Republican and sometimes a lot like Mr. Trump, with his missives on Twitter against woke politics and COVID restrictions, his attacks on elite media, and his efforts to draw attention to allegations that Hunter Biden profited from his father's political clout. He has stressed repeatedly that his problems are with extremists on both ends of the political spectrum. Okay, so New York Times, I understand that he might say that, but this was pitched as an article doing analysis. Maybe you can dive into that claim and figure out if there's anything to it. Yes, he says he has a problem with the extremists on both sides, but does he actually? Has he demonstrated that in his daily communications? Those he is engaging with on Twitter now that he owns it. Is it clear that he is worried equally about extremists on both sides? And look, I'm not even asking for you to do a far more substantive analysis of the idea of there being extremists on both sides and actually dive into if there is any way to compare those two things and the threat they pose to a constitutional democracy. But at the very least, you could be a little bit more critical about Elon Musk, who has provided no lack of evidence of what he truly believes. We're gonna dive into that evidence in just a minute, but River, what do you make of this?
Well, I personally think that the New York Times should do a better job of just asking some questions when it comes to the analysis of the political leanings of Elon Musk, as opposed to, say, healthcare for trans people. They can't stop asking questions about the validity of trans people as a population, but when it comes to a so-called billionaire and like handout from the government receiver, they just don't, they just can't seem to ask any hard-hitting questions in their analysis of it. It's absolutely hilarious to me how much cover they will run for Elon Musk, but will constantly put targets on the back of trans people specifically. That's just one place that I can draw, you know, the issue. There's many other ones, but this is the one. It's and they don't mention his consistent and repeated transphobia, which is one of the main you know, contrarian points these days. And I think that guy specifically has a lot in the transphobic camp, mostly because his trans daughter can't stand him. But you know, that's a little personal.
I think that's obviously a big part. I also think that it's an easy way. Oh, awesome. Thank you, Cliff. That was great. And then you guys didn't get to see the ninja maneuvers to get out of there. You could have just gotten up. We're not, this ain't CNN. Anyway, thank you. I think that's definitely one of the reasons. I also think that engaging in transphobia is a shortcut to getting the right to love you. I think that you just say that, it doesn't matter what your positions on basically anything else are. So I think it's a combination of the personal and the pragmatic. But I want to do a little bit of a favor for the New York Times, help them to do their job. Elon Musk literally told everyone on Twitter to vote for Republicans in the midterm elections. I don't know what more he could do to get this across, but he was trying. He tweeted out, "My pronouns are prosecute Fauci," which is a little twofer. It's their one joke on the right, with also saying that Dr. Fauci should be jailed for trying to stop people needlessly dying from COVID. Okay, that's fun. You have him responding to a tweet asking him to please stop attacking the LGBTQ community by saying, "I strongly disagree. Forcing your pronouns upon others when they didn't ask and implicitly ostracizing those who don't is neither good nor kind to anyone." Okay, so again, he's engaging in that. Look, again, nobody should be surprised by this because this isn't new. He's been doing this for a long time. What is maybe a little bit more new is this: follow the white rabbit. Now, if you're a sane person whose skin has made contact with grass in the past few months, you might not know what he's saying there. But what he's doing is trying to appeal to the QAnoners, because since 2018, the saying follow the white rabbit has become synonymous with QAnon. And when pushers of the conspiracy urge others to look into the movement, they explicitly talk about white rabbits. He knows this. That's why he's doing it. And some Elon cultists might say, well, no, he doesn't like actually believe it. He's just like trolling you by putting it. No, but that's my point. Do you get that the richest person in the world who now owns Twitter having fun trolling people over a conspiracy theory that has already resulted in people being killed might not be a good thing? Do you get that? Probably not. You can't get through to these people. Oh, by the way, he also disbanded the Trust and Safety Council for Twitter because again, he is very sensitive if you criticize him. He will literally take down Twitter accounts if you spread videos of him being booed. But a council that is supposed to stop the constant organized harassment campaigns against marginalized communities, we don't need that anymore. We can get rid of that river.
Yeah, let's get rid of it all. Free speech means free being a jerk, I guess. I don't know. It's just very funny how, like, I don't know, debate culture has grown into this. Like, I just, and the trolling thing, the whole like just mind game of like, yeah, don't feed the troll. Blah, blah, blah. I've been told for I've been terminally online for way too long. And so I know too much. I feel like, John, we both know too much. There are many people that don't know most of this, and I am very jealous of them. But that has been the consistent drumbeat for people that aren't paying attention, I guess, that like, oh, just it's just trolling. And it's like, we're beyond that point. Like, we're beyond the point that anything is just trolling. Everything has a momentum and everything serves a purpose. So to say these QAnon things, you're saying QAnon things. Like, there's no game to it. Even if you're trying to play a game, you're participating in it. And if you have, you know, white parents in the Midwest, you know what this stuff is doing. You know, like it's dangerous and it's not to be taken lightly. Just like, yeah, you know, the stuff we just talked about in the last segment. It's like it's to be taken seriously. Like, these things have serious implications to say them. And I would also say that my pronouns are prosecute Fauci or whatever. They're one joke. Also, that was our joke. Like, trans people have been making that joke for way longer. Like, we have a sense of humor about our own shit that they don't. Our own stuff, excuse me, that they don't. And that's what's so funny is like, they can't even come up with, their most consistent joke was our joke. So like, they can't come up with anything original, which is really funny to me.
I mean, it's sort of consistent with Elon Musk. His entire sense of humor is just stealing people's memes and not even bothering to like the original post before he steals it.
He's just done F Jerry to the, you know, to the moon, literally. And now he's like, I just think this is all, you know, a political play to like even pretend run for president or whatever. That's like where we've gotten in our society, culture, government, whatever, is that it's all just to make money and all just a PR stunt. Like, nothing is of any substance anymore. You know, like Tesla, the company, isn't really of any substance. Like, they make cars that explode and run around and run people over. Like, this is not, we're not actually moving anything forward. We're not, everything is snake oil at this point. And everyone is participating in just political relations at this point, and it's pretty scary.
Yeah, well, why don't we turn now to the effect of that? Because this actually, I think, is very interesting, and maybe will make people feel better about this multi-month Elon Musk thing we're all going through. People are waking up to Elon Musk, which is mildly ironic since he's freaked out anytime the concept of being woke comes up. Anyway, what people think of Elon Musk is beginning to move as a result of his daily quest to be the absolute worst. There's a poll being done by YouGov comparing evaluations of Elon Musk on a bunch of different descriptors from April to December. So basically from the beginning of this whole Twitter thing to now. And take a look at the movement on different descriptors. Would you describe Elon Musk as X? Amazingly, those describing him as rich has dropped by 5 points, which I think is ridiculous. I mean, admittedly, yes, he is no longer the richest person in the world, at least as of today. He slipped down to number two, but he's still objectively rich either way. An entrepreneur is down, innovator down by 8 points, a visionary down by 6 points, an inventor down by 9 points. Again, I cannot remind people enough, he didn't invent any of this stuff. Whether he manages a rocket company or a car company or a tunnel boring company well or not is an interesting debate that we can have. He didn't invent any of those things. Hundreds or thousands of engineers did. Let's be clear about that. But anyway, other things going down. You've got, well, self-made, brilliant, mildly. Now, some things have gone up. People are more likely to consider him funny. 5 points up. It's still a low percentage, but you know, right wingers have no standards, so they think he's funny. That's fine. Right wing is up 7 points. A disruptor is up 5 points, although no word on whether people consider that a good or a bad thing. Impulsive is up 8 points, which is amazing. Also, left wing is up 2 points because there's going to be some stupid people who respond to every poll. But anyway, what I like about this is while I think the effect should be bigger, all I want in the world, other than a solution to climate change and a second season of Dark Crystal, is for effects or for events to have consequences. For a person to show the world they're right wing and crazy, and for them to come away from that thinking, oh, that person is right wing and crazy. I want a world governed by reason. And this poll indicates that at least a little bit of that world might be present. But River, what do you think?
Well, I think that the only thing that Elon Musk has invented in his lifetime is Elon Musk. So he does have that one thing that he's invented. And I agree with you, John. I will say, look, I'm just gonna offer that we already do live in that world that you're looking for. Because if for that guy to go on stage at a Dave Chappelle concert and be booed, actions have consequences. That is pure and inarguable evidence that actions have consequences. It turns out if you take something that people enjoy, whether they say so or not, but you take a product that people enjoy or a service or whatever, in this case, Twitter, and you decimate it to the point that they don't enjoy it anymore and they leave that service, they're gonna have some feelings about that, you know, which is, I will say, why the right wing refuses to provide anything for the people of this in and coming to this country, because they know they'll have to keep doing it. So they pretend that they can't, and they pretend that they already have. And this is what Elon Musk is doing. His whole thing is, I've given you everything, and can't you imagine this future that I'm gonna create? And that future keeps getting kicked down the road like the hat, you know, like in Charlie Chaplin. It's like it never comes. But he is being seen for what he is, which is you know, the man behind the curtain, the wizard.
I'm glad that you reminded me of the Dave Chappelle thing, because that is pretty amazing. I mean, it's difficult to know exactly what the composition of a Dave Chappelle audience would be right now.
Because it's not an unhinged leftist audience, which is what Elon Musk was trying to say. It's not unhinged leftist in San Francisco, I'll tell you that.
That's definitely true. I just, like, he can do these things. By the way, all of his terrible tweets and everything that we were listing, I'm not implying that any of that's illegal or anything. He can make Twitter his own personal cult and cesspool of toxicity. He can do that. What he can't do is do that and still have it be a place that reasonable people want to be at and communicate on and advertise on. That's all I'm saying. He can make it whatever he wants it to be, in the same way that the prior ownership of Twitter can, without that being violations of the First Amendment, as we've always said. But we want people to actually accurately read what it is that he's doing. Okay, I think we're gonna take an early second break, because I think we're having a little bit of tech issues. So we're gonna take a break, we're gonna resolve those. And when we come back, we've got a lot more news to talk about, including some more attacks against Kyrsten Sinema, which I know you're gonna enjoy. We'll be right back. Okay, we're gonna see if we can get that resolved. We might have to move to like a screen and just do voice, maybe? Anyway, we'll see. While we work on that, why don't we jump into this?
Were you surprised by Sinema's announcement?
Not really. I thought she was gonna do this eventually. Look, she claims to be independent. That's not the case. The case is that she can't win a primary against me, and this is her only option. And more importantly, you know, she really has just abandoned the values of Arizona. And her being independent has nothing to do with the values of Arizona. It just means that she has an easier time to run, and she could go and talk to her friends in Wall Street and in the pharma companies. But at the end of the day, she long ago abandoned Arizona when it comes to representing their values.
I think that Ruben Gallego is 100% right there. Both his read of who she is, and I'm going to talk more about values in this context, but also why she made this move. She's not growing ideologically more distinct from the Democratic Party, as I broke down on the Young Turks last week. If anything, she is totally in lockstep with one of the core operating concerns of both the Democrat and the Republican parties, the need to effectively gum up the works so big economic changes in policy have no chance of actually succeeding. She's not different than them in that way. She's the ultimate version of that. But she does need to stay in office, and I agree with Ruben Gallego. I don't think that she could have won a primary against him. It's a far more interesting maybe question now going forward, what effect she'll have as a third party candidate. And we'll return to that in just a moment. But I want to talk about values, because I care about values. My work as a political psychologist in grad school was about the formation and development of political values and value systems. And so I love talking about values, but I also acknowledge that sometimes talking about values is a way to not talk about something else. And very often for corporate Democrats, it's a way to not talk about policies. And that's actually a point that Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez made in her initial response to Sinema's announcement. I want to read that for you because we didn't actually get to it last week. She said, not once in this long soliloquy does Sinema offer a single concrete value or policy she believes in. She lays out no goals for Arizonans, no vision, no commitments. It's no healthcare, just vibes for Senate. People deserve more. Grateful this race and nomination has opened up. And we'll talk more about the nomination, but think about that. It's not, here are the five things I want to accomplish that my prior position in the Democratic Party made it impossible for me to accomplish. It's just, I have a value of independence. I have Arizona values. Yeah, but specifically what? Specifically, what do Arizonans value? It's not actually impossible to figure that out. You can take a look at the promises you made when you were originally getting elected. Or if you don't want to go back that far, you can take a look at the actual values that were on display in Arizona elections in the midterms. Where did the people go? What was it clear that Arizonans wanted coming out of that? Did they support Joe Biden? It turns out that they did in Arizona. What was he campaigning on? And why were you so instrumental in stopping his policy agenda from moving forward when your own constituents showed that they supported that agenda when they picked Joe Biden for president just a couple of years ago? Again, like, I'm engaging in, I guess, pointless rhetorical questions, because it's not like she's waiting for a challenge to engage in these grounds. She doesn't actually stand for policy, or at least policy changes. Just by being an obstacle, she does stand for certain policies. It's the policies that they already have. She is there to keep the tax rate as low as it is, to keep corporate taxes especially as low as they are, to maintain the tax loopholes that have been enshrined into law over the past decade. That is a policy position, but they sort of get it for free, these corporate Democrats, because they just have to stop anything from happening. They don't have to advocate for something. They don't have to organize and rally support to get something passed. They just have to stop anything from changing the dominant economic position that the wealthy 1% corporations already have in our society. Now, we're gonna return later on in the coming months as we continue our campaign to stop her from holding elected office, in trying to figure out what effect she would have if she ran a third party candidate. And look, I have heard reasonable people make both cases that having a Democrat run with her as a third party candidate would definitely throw the race to the Republican. I've also heard a pretty good analysis for why the opposite might happen. I am not an expert in Arizona politics. I can't answer that conundrum for you. But what I do know is something that was echoed by Representative Gallego in his interview. It's that Democrats don't like her. Republicans like her more. And so if you're trying to figure out where those votes will go with her as a third party candidate, potential spoiler in that, well, you could take a look at these results and you can see what people think about her. I will never tire in pointing out, in graphic four, I should say, in pointing out how much basically every group in society absolutely despises her. It's just, we're gonna have to figure out exactly how that's gonna shake out when we get to an actual vote, if and when she does run. in 2024. Okay, I do want to move on to the D block. Do we have any determination on what we're going to do here? Do we have a slate that we can put up a river to at least comment on? Is that a thing? Okay, I'm gonna intro the topic and we'll see what we can do. I know behind the scenes, everybody's doing everything they can to resolve the situation, everybody. And thank you for being patient with us. We don't have Daily Wire money. We don't have CNN money. So sometimes these little tech problems can develop. Anyway, with that said, let's move into another topic. The family of a police officer who died under mysterious circumstances during a training exercise have now filed a lawsuit saying that they believe that this was retaliatory violence as a result of that police officer violating what is considered the blue wall of silence. We'll give you details on what the family has said and what actually happened to LA officer Houston Tipping. But yes, they have put forward this actual lawsuit now. It's a result of him dying as a result of catastrophic spinal injuries earlier this year. They say that the department and the city allowed him, Houston Tipping, to teach a class with a reputation for being physical without a supervisor being present, with officers that he'd been actively investigating over allegations of sexual assault. And I'm gonna let them now jump in and give a little bit of information about this case and what they believe. Let's take a look at this.
In July of 2021, four police officers were involved in a sexual assault of a woman in the Los Angeles area. A report was taken by Officer Tipping, and I've seen that report. And that report indicates that there was a sexual attack, and it indicates that an object was placed into the sexual organ of the female victim. And the female victim claimed that she was raped by four different people, all LAPD officers. She knew the names of some of those officers because they were in uniform and they had their name tags on. And that name of one of those officers with the name tag seems to correlate with one of the officers that was at the bicycle training.
And you're alleging that that officer is the one who hurt Houston Tipping?
Correct.
So look, I'm not a lawyer, nor am I an expert on this particular case, but these are the allegations that are being made. Bradley Gage, the attorney for Tipping's mother, says it smacks of a cover up that you have an individual being unsupervised, having to work in a physical environment with someone who's being actively investigated for an alleged sexual assault. And then these mysterious things happen. But the mystery actually goes a little bit beyond what we've already talked about. On May 29th, 2022, Tipping died from the spinal cord injury that we've been talking about after teaching a multi-day training program about using bicycles for crowd control. While the officer allegedly dropping Tipping may explain that injury, he also suffered broken ribs 2 days before his death, a collapsed lung, liver damage, brain bleeding, and a head laceration that required 6 staples at the time of his death. The LAPD initially blamed Tipping's injured liver injury and broken ribs on an automatic CPR machine known as a Lucas device. But medical records obtained by the family's legal team shows the device, which can break a person's ribs in order to save their life, was attached to the officer but never actually activated. Which again, I can't attest to whether that's true or not. It seems like there would be a log of that. It seems sort of convenient to blame it on that, but if it wasn't activated, then it literally cannot be an explanation for those injuries. And so again, look, obviously this case is complicated, but this being a police department, especially the LAPD, which we know has a particularly toxic environment with gang activity and criminality and cover-ups going back a very long time, a lot of people are very concerned about what's truly behind this case. River, I don't know how much of that you were able to follow with our tech problems, but let me know what you think.
Yeah, no, I caught that story, and being somebody who lives in Los Angeles, I've been aware of this case and what happened. And I mean, the only thing I can say is that, you know, it turns out that violence is a very violent business, you know, and the LAPD specifically is in the business of violence, you know. And I would hope that this story would get you know, more eyes, more visibility. Thank you for covering it. Because I think that it's important to show that you know, often people for whatever reason can sort of dismiss the violence that police, specifically the LAPD, takes out on protesters, the unhoused black people, whatever, we can sort of diminish that in our brains. But this case is police officers allegedly, probably murdering another police officer for doing what we all want reform to do. So we to do in the case of police officers. And I think that this case can prove that that is not possible. You can't you can't investigate yourself, you know. So and when someone is outside of you and still a police officer, they will do what they can to stop that from coming out. So I think it's I wish this family, you know, peace around this, but I think that, you know, it's an important case for the country at large to see, especially right now, that it's toxic, it's violent, and something more needs to be done than just reform and pouring more money into the police.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. And we don't know. We can only follow the case. We're not making any specific claims because we don't know, but definitely going to be interested to see how this shakes out.
That's right.
Okay. With that said, let's talk about one more quick topic before we close out for the first hour. Let's jump to this video whenever we're ready.
Would you publicly say that Donald Trump bears any responsibility for some of the losses in the midterm elections? Would you say that publicly?
You know, I don't like this.
Well, yeah, I get why you wouldn't like that necessarily. You don't want to have to come out against Donald Trump, Ronna McDaniel, but it's pretty clear he was involved in the red wave dissipating. So you're going to have to take a stance, but she's good at self-preservation, as you'll see in this next clip.
I don't like these parceling out because he supported Ted Budd who won and he supported JD Vance who won. I think there's a lot of things. That's why I've put together an after action report. We've got to look at Dobbs. But here's the one thing that I think people should be talking about, the amount of ticket splitting, the amount of Republicans that went out and voted for a Republican at the top of the ticket. Look at Arizona. The top vote getter is a Republican. Look at Georgia. We had 8 of 9 statewide races won by Republicans. But why are Republicans going and voting for one Republican and not the other?
Trump.
We have to work hard to bring those independents
in. Isn't that the answer to
that means turnout was not the
question. The answer is Trump, isn't it?
I'm saying I'm not into the blame game right now. I think we've got to do an analysis. I think it's too quick. And I think you can't parcel out, well, this endorsement helped this one and this. It's the whole message.
No, I think in that analysis, you probably could figure out which endorsements were important. And especially if you want to say, I want to understand the ticket splitting. I want to know why some non-Trump supported candidates did well and the ones that Trump supported didn't do well. But I don't want to do the blame game. I want to know what's to blame, but not if it's Trump. I don't want to say him specifically, which is interesting because she could go against him. Some Republicans have. They seem to be reading the wind and thinking that Donald Trump is not going to be as influential in the future as he has been up to this point. She's making a different determination and having to tap dance around the indisputable. Limited credit to Stuart Varney for calling it like it is when it comes to the midterm elections there. But Ronna McDaniel, it's ridiculous and shameless how unwilling she is to acknowledge Donald Trump's effect on the midterms. River, what do you think?
I mean, I think you've got Teflon Don, and now you've got Teflon Ronna McDaniel.
Teflon McDaniel.
That's right. Some effective tap dancing around the blame game and all those things. I mean, it's just into, you know, there's one thing that the contemporary GOP, and I'm talking about the corporation and the people running it, the one thing they will never do is take responsibility. So that this falls in line, this interview falls in line with that modus operandi, you know?
Yeah. Well, we're gonna see. She's facing a lot of pressure to step down, be replaced. Maybe she thinks that with Donald Trump backing her, she can keep her position. Maybe it's less about protecting him, more about protecting herself. We'll have to see if she's able to weather that storm. Now, we do have to close out this first hour. Thank you, everyone who's been watching. There's a lot more show to come, though, in the aftermath. So if you're on Twitch or YouTube, stay tuned. More coming up after this.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.